start, of course, and let you repeat some of your key points from your beautiful keynote. So I think we're good. Will you just tell me?
By the way, the slides are probably available on the website.
I have them.
Oh, you have them. Okay.
Yeah. Let me just do a sound check. All right. I think we're good. Our levels are good. And let's have a nice conversation, which is what I'm looking forward to. It's the way I like to work.
All right.
And I'll just intro us. You're listening to Barbara Glickstein. You're tuned into Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. My guest is Dr. Michel Kazikin. He's the United Nations Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. We are reporting here from Melbourne, Australia, at the International Congress of Nurses, where 4,000 plus nurses just heard Dr. Kazikin deliver his keynote, Equity and Access to Healthcare. Welcome to Health Styles.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara.
Please tell me correctly if I'm pronouncing your name.
You are pronouncing it correctly. It's not an easy name. It's a Russian name. However, when my parents immigrated from Russia to Europe, to Western Europe, they immigrated to France. That's why the name is pronounced Kazikin. It's a sort of French way of pronouncing it, although it's a Russian name.
All right, well, thank
Difficult. You. Difficult. I realize that. I've experienced that throughout my life.
Thank you for your kindness. Well, you just spoke to 4,000 global nurses about the issue of HIV/AIDS, equity, and access to health care. What does it mean to speak to global nurses about this issue? Being a leader in the HIV/AIDS work for over 25 years, how have nurses contributed to this, and where can we go as nurses going forward?
Two things here, Barbara. First, I have been using AIDS as a sort of model. I've been drawing lessons from 30 years of fight against AIDS to try and understand what are the factors that can help us elaborate a global response against disease, that can help us build global solidarity around an issue and make progress promoting health and therefore reducing the inequities. Because my point is that health is the most evident and the first of the inequities wherever you go. The second point, my second point answering your question is that, as I said from the beginning, nurses to me are the bedrock of healthcare everywhere, and I've seen that everywhere in the world, and I've traveled everywhere. At the end of my talk, I mentioned some of the places that came to my mind. Let me just elaborate on that. I started with Paris because in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, where there were 2 to 3 deaths in our ward per week, I remember my nurse team and staff, and how we collectively, doctors and nurses, were receiving support from a psychologist as a group, as a team. Not in days where hospitals were much more sort of hierarchic, than they are now. And I think AIDS and the difficulties we were facing were already helping us to a notion of teamwork, which did not maybe exist as much in academic hospitals, at least. Then I remembered some of the work in Khayelitsha, South Africa, where I have seen pioneering work on what's called task shifting, where actually nurses are doing what doctors do elsewhere, and healthcare workers trained for 2 months are doing what nurses do elsewhere. So the patient comes, he sees a health worker. Health worker check asks 10 questions. If you answer yes or no, whatever, let's say yes to all of the 10 questions, you leave with your drugs and you go back home. if you have answered no to one or two of the questions, you see a nurse. She has 10 things to check and 10 questions to ask. If it's a yes to everything, then after seeing the nurse, you take your pills and go home. If there is a no to one question or something abnormal at the physical examination that she carries, then you see a doctor. That's just an extraordinary system that has allowed healthcare, you know, to expand to hundreds of thousands in countries where there is very little medical staff. And then I remembered, I mentioned this morning some of the nurses in the working with people who use drugs in Ho Chi Minh City, in a very difficult environment with where prohibition law enforcement really dominates the scene, and where it's difficult to delineate between what is should be healthcare and what is actually incarceration and forced rehabilitation. And finally, I thought of some of the nurses in the TB hospital in St. Petersburg, but I can also think of Ukraine and some of these regions where MDR-TB now is threatening. So what I'm saying here is that wherever I've been, I've seen nurses at the forefront of the battle with compassionate commitment, professionalism, high ethics in their work. And one of the points of my talks was that if you really wish to fight inequities through helping access to care, it's not just a matter of setting the structures, of having the standards, the guidelines, of making the politics right. It's also about keeping people compassionate.
You did share a beautiful quote, which we can get to in just a moment at the towards the end of your speech about compassion. The image that I think you're referring to was the one of the male being administered an antiviral medication or a medication while imprisoned in Ukraine. Is that correct?
It's the opposite. Ah. That's the interesting thing about that picture. It is a person using drugs who is seeking health care in a clinic. And while he's receiving health care, you can see the door of the room in the hospital sort of being half opened, and behind it stands a policeman. Because what I've seen and heard a lot in Ukraine, in Russia, in those settings, is that because, again, prohibition law enforcement is so harsh, whenever that person may actually leave the room of the hospital, that person may be arrested or harassed by the police. But that is not only in Russia. You know that 50% of the people in the federal prison system in the U.S. are there for drug offenses, including minor drug offenses. And I think one of the reasons we're deviating from from the topic, but one of the reasons why America is now sort of considering changing drug policies, why Colorado, Washington have been voting, you know, to legalize marijuana, I think, is that people are fed up seeing all of the money going to prisons rather than to health and education.
Well, we now are we hold the terrible position in the United States as having more people incarcerated than anywhere in the world. So we have surpassed Russia.
1.7% of the population.
Yes. Probably another interview, which I'd be very happy to schedule with you. What I wanted to ask you, since Central Asia and Eastern Europe is where you are a special envoy, and just to stay on Russia for another moment, is the question about the new laws in Russia for NGOs coming under pressure, where they're required to register as, quote, foreign agents, and end quote. Do you see that as having an impact in any of the work of the NGOs who were there to both prevent HIV/AIDS as well as to seek treatment for those in the community who are testing positive?
Yes, I see two very negative impacts of that law. First, indeed, many NGOs that were working with international funding cannot continue their work and cannot continue and do not receive core funding anymore. I have been the head of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB and Malaria for 5 years. We did have large prevention programs and harm reduction programs for people who use drugs in many countries in the region, including in Russia. And since the Global Fund is not working anymore in Russia, that's for reasons that Russia is no more eligible because of its economic status. But since the Global Fund is not there anymore, the prevention programs have just dropped dramatically. And the other impact, unfortunate impact that I am seeing, is that the civil society, which is strong, you know, I see them as really heroes. The civil society is splitting under the pressure. So part of it is saying, okay, we continue to fight, we continue to denunciation, we continue, and we don't care if we're treated as, quote, foreign agents or called foreign agents or whatever. We don't care. The other part is saying, well, if we don't work somehow with the government, we'll never achieve anything. And so there is another part of the civil society that is sort of entering a negotiation with the government. But that creates a split within the civil society movement. Maybe that's what one of the aims of that law also is, to divide.
Yes, I think there's a lot to be, we need to follow going forward, not in that region of the world, particularly around the epidemic of HIV/AIDS. As you mentioned in your talk, that IV drug users are the largest population, and then based on the history of what we've seen in other parts of the world, then we begin to see a rise in women becoming infected, in those who are in heterosexual relationships with those IV drug users.
That's what's happening there in Russia, in Ukraine. The two countries are 95% of the 1.4 million people infected in the region. The epidemic is clearly shifting now from being a concentrated epidemic among people who use drugs into what, you know, we call a generalized epidemic that is heterosexually transmitted. But the reservoir, I hate this word, you know, but let's use it, where it comes from is originally the people who use drugs, and the people who use drugs, they kept being infected in the last 10 years because of the law enforcement that was actually driving people underground. People were prevented from using services. There were no services anyway, and they were driven underground to actually inject in unsafe environments.
And as a public health nurse in the United States, it's important for me to also say that we face similar problems of lack of treatment as well as an approach to people who are using substance. I had the pleasure of meeting and interviewing nurses from Vancouver who do street nursing. You probably are familiar with this model.
Yes, I am, yes. Vancouver is an extraordinary model where they've actually shown how helping people access preventative services, and now having people who use drugs broadly access antiretroviral drugs, has actually contributed to decreasing the epidemic among people who use drugs drastically.
And from what I understand, though, there's a trend moving away from funding these programs, and we need to keep our eye on that to be sure that that harm reduction programs globally are supported, and the stigma that creates the lack of funding and attention to people who are substance users be addressed, and the general public understand that this is a better model than incarcerating people and not letting them have access to clean needles.
Absolutely. And Barbara, if we can stay 1 second or go back 1 second again to the U.S., what, you know, I find sort of frustrating is that while the U.S. had a 20-year ban on funding needle exchange, internally and in foreign assistance programs, President Obama lifted that ban as soon as he came to presidency. And then 2 years later, he had to reinstate that ban under pressure from the Congress, which is another point I was trying to make in my talk today, which is that at the end, somewhere, health is politics.
You made some very critical points about where we've come in the last 30 years and the progress. Will you restate some of the progress and then talk about where we need to go?
Well, what again, I used AIDS as a model and as an example, and the progress, for example, is that of access to treatment. In the early 2000s, you know, when the G8 decided to tackle HIV/AIDS, and AIDS came on the global agenda, as we call it, there were a few tens of thousands, if I remember, in 2000, 30,000 people receiving antiretroviral treatment in Africa who were paying for it. And that was 6 years after the Vancouver conference, AIDS conference, where the effectiveness of antiretroviral and triple combination therapy was shown. And so 5 years after widespread dissemination of those treatments in the rich world. So a few tens of thousands. Today, it's 8 million people. So I don't think any of us experts, you know, would have believed that or would have predicted that. Remember, in those days, people were saying drugs are too expensive, there are no infrastructures and no health workforce in these countries, patients will not be able to take these complicated drugs, it's not cost effective, and anyway, the problem is so huge, we'll never get at it, yes? And all of that proved to be wrong.
Thank goodness.
To me, it's a really a lesson. When the world comes together and decides to globally tackle an issue, it's capable of moving mountains. And as a result, I've shown this morning that the mortality from AIDS has decreased 25% in the last 5 years globally, and the new infections as well. But that's globally. If you look at Southern Africa, in some countries, Botswana, new infections have dropped 70%. So the mean of 25% is there because there are still areas in the world, including Eastern Europe and Central Asia, where the epidemic continues to grow. And then what I've been doing throughout my talk is trying to reflect on what are the reasons for this extraordinary progress. And I've listed a few of them: activism and social mobilization. Which you in New York, know particularly well what it has been in the 80s. But that is something that has spread worldwide. Think of the activism in South Africa, when the activists put the government and pharma to trial. And acknowledge the political commitment, and I have great respect for the G8 leaders in the early 2000s in their commitment. Remember the Okinawa, but then the Gleneagles summit and the commitment to fund a development aid for Africa. These were the days when there was a rich global north and a poor global south, as I said. The whole geopolitical and economical map has changed now, but there was a commitment of this group of people, although they were as politically diverse as President Bush, President Chirac, Tony Blair, or Prime Minister Mori from Japan in those days. Third factor is what I called innovation. In order to really expand access to care at the global public health level, we needed innovation. So we needed a complex treatment regimen to become a one pill a day regimen, which the Indian generic makers invented. In order to have hundreds of thousands of people access treatment, we needed nurses to do what doctors used to do and healthcare workers to do what nurses used to do. That's called task shifting. In order for all of these decisions to be taken in a consensus matter and not have the civil society confront the governments and the public sector, we needed a new form of governance and decision making, which I called democratization of the decision making, which happened through, for example, the creation of the Global Fund, that for a donor institution is unique in that it has a board where donors and beneficiaries are equally represented with equal rights of votes. So all of these factors somehow, and of course, you know, the science, which wasn't the topic of this talk, but the progress in science, knowledge, understanding of the disease, be it biological sciences or social sciences, has helped tremendously. So we have to take the lessons from this. And to me, the lesson is the world coming together in deciding that a global issue requires a global attention, global solidarity, global funding. And the world is paying that sort of attention now to environment, to water sanitation, to energy somehow, and therefore health is now competing. But at the same time, I was saying that I see new challenges now, because of course the fiscal and economic crisis is putting a lot of pressure, because it's not now a matter of a global north and a global south, a global rich north and a poor global south. The map has changed. It's now a multipolar world, which may be a good thing, but it may also somehow have regional agendas coming before as a priority, somehow national or regional agendas as priorities coming before a global agenda and a global attention. It's much more difficult to bring that multipolar world together, I believe. So many changes, and one of the major changes that I've been discussing is that the map of poverty and therefore of marginalization and poorer access to health has changed. It is now poverty, the poor people, for 70% of them in the world, are now in the so-called middle-income countries and emerging economies, where we see rich people become richer and poor people become poorer. So that gap of inequity is growing within countries, including in our rich countries. And that is a huge challenge for us when it comes to addressing those inequity in access to healthcare.
These issues of inequities are seen to impact all peoples and not just those who are poor. And we understand how it's as though the canary in the coal mine, the idea that all of us are breathing the same air, and when things become less available to the poor and their health is not paid attention to, we know it impacts the economies, we know it impacts the public health. The diseases that we begin to see again on the rise have to do with our not paying attention to all populations at whatever level they are in their economy.
Of course, and one of the best examples there is TB. And the actual, there are less, TB is decreasing somehow, but it remains a terrible threat throughout the world. And with social marginalization and more challenges in access to healthcare, what is increasing is the relative proportion of MDR TB, multi-drug resistant TB cases, among TB cases. So the number of people who now present already with a multi-drug resistant TB from first presentation, or who are, or the proportion of MDR TB cases among people that we call people coming for retreatment after they failed the first treatment, is growing. is growing, and that is clearly linked with poverty, with marginalization, and with challenges to access to healthcare.
You mentioned that you're leaving Melbourne, Australia, where we are at the International Congress of Nursing. My guest on Health Styles, which is what you're listening to here on WBAI, is Dr. Michelle Kazatchkin. Dr. Kazatchkin is the Special Envoy, United Nations Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. He just completed a keynote to 4,000 plus nurses on equity and access to healthcare. You're en route to Paris, and you are going to the 30th anniversary of HIV/AIDS and the question of vaccinations. I asked you earlier, and I'll repeat my question, about the role of media in the coverage of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in its history and today, where as a reporter in the United States, I see less coverage. So we're hoping that next week, while you're in Paris, perhaps some of the innovations and questions of access to care and equity will come up. Is that your hope?
It is certainly my hope, because I'm absolutely convinced that media have a key role to play in bringing issues, successes, failures, or when an issue is difficult, let's say drug policy, which we mentioned earlier, media are key in opening the debate. And unless we talk about issues, the issues are forgotten and left aside. So I agree with your comment, which is that we've lately seen in the last 4 to 5 years less press on HIV/AIDS, TB. And here I'm not sort of defending AIDS against other diseases. Again, I'm taking AIDS as a model of a success story. I could take malaria, I could take TB, so that we draw the lessons and then take this as an extraordinary, I think the most extraordinary success we have had in global public health in general. I feel sorry that press is only interested by an extraordinary finding. One day, shall we have a vaccine, is the question. As if, by the way, the vaccine was the only way to prevent HIV. No, it's not. And now, in the US, in Western Europe, and in some countries in the developing world, there are almost no more children born with HIV from HIV-positive mothers. Success of prevention, because we know how to prevent. In my country, France, there's basically no more person using drugs who becomes infected with HIV because of widespread harm reduction. So we don't need a vaccine. And if you have, if you use a condom, you know, that's more effective than whatever vaccine you can think of. So a vaccine will come, will be helpful, but think of all the diseases for which we have vaccines, measles, hepatitis B, whatever, and still that hasn't eradicated. So let's not, you know, of course we all wish, you know, that we have a vaccine for HIV/AIDS and that we have a cure. But let's first also focus on applying at the largest scale possible the tools we have, which currently allow for people who start treatment to live a healthy life with a life expectancy similar to HIV negative people, basically, and for many instances prevention to be highly efficacious. So I hope press. I hope we now have to look for sort of opportunities for press to become interested. And next week is the 30th anniversary of the first publication in Science of the article that identified HIV, that wasn't called HIV at that time, as the virus, the causative agent for AIDS. And that has really been an absolutely key discovery that then has allowed progress in understanding the disease and in producing the appropriate drugs. I hope that that provides the opportunity to discuss not only the science of HIV, but also all of these lessons that HIV has brought to the world in terms of public health.
You mentioned some surprises being an expert in the field and being so engaged and a leader for 30 years. Did you ever imagine we would talk about HIV/AIDS as a chronic disease?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, you mean 30 years ago?
Yes.
Or 20 years ago? No, I certainly wouldn't. You know, I even remember the 80s in the beginning when we, you know, I've seen the first screening of blood donors in 1984, before screening of blood donors became compulsory, and when we were still not quite certain about the quality of the tests. They were being certified, but we started testing people in the hospital where I worked. And in those days, we didn't know that AIDS would be a disease that, in the absence of treatment, in 100% of the cases, basically, leads to increasing immune deficiency and ultimately and eventually to death. We thought perhaps, like hepatitis, we would have people who remain healthy, although they have the virus. We call them healthy carriers of the virus in those days. So we didn't know. And of course, we didn't know whether we would have treatment one day and whether treatment would really turn AIDS into a manageable chronic condition. And I do know now so many patients who are taking their treatment, who feel well. It's not 100% of the cases, but I know so many of them, just as I know people who take a drug against hypertension or against high levels of cholesterol or whatever. And that has helped considerably demystifying the disease. And so access to treatment is also a powerful anti-stigma drug, if I may say so.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon in Melbourne, Australia, at the International Congress of Nursing. My guest is Dr. Michelle Kazakhkin, who delivered the keynote on equity and access to health care. He is the United States Special Envoy
for Nations.
United Nations. Oh, that was a big slip. United Nations Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. Thank you so much for your time and for your incredible delivery of that keynote this morning. It was deeply moving and spot on.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.